Welcome to the Authentic Conversations podcast with Give Impact. Here are your hosts, Liz Ward and Maya Davis.
All right. That one's a little higher pitched today. Well, welcome back, everybody, for episode number 10 of Authentic Conversations. I'm so pumped that we are here. And it's our first episode with a client. I know. Watch out, right? But thankfully, Andy's been working with us for a very long time and knows us pretty well. But we've got Andy Mermans from the Maroncus Foundation. And I often tell people that you and your wife and your family that I've met are like among my favorite humans group. We just love working with you guys.
1,000,000%.
Yep. It's so much fun. And so thank you for...
We've deceived you all.
Anyways, we're excited to have you here. The Maroncus Foundation, Andy, you'll talk about that in a little bit, but is locally based and doing a lot of really incredible work in investing in our people, in our humans, and they have been a big part of our journey over the last 3 years. So I'm going to let Maya and Courtney say hi first.
Well, hello, hello.
Hello, hello.
And just in case you didn't catch it on the last episode, Maya is about half-baked.
We're 19 weeks today.
On baby boy. So we're very excited, and we just want to make sure everybody gets to celebrate with us. But happy, healthy pregnancy so far. So we're very excited for you.
I'm grateful for a healthy pregnancy for sure.
Well, you want to kick us off?
Sure. So, yes, we work with Andy on the professional basis, but he's an amazing human, and we just happen to share the same birthday, which makes us extra special people.
Scorpios.
And it's coming up soon. So I just want you to share your name with the listeners and where you're originally from.
So I'm Andy Mermans. I am originally from Charlotte.
Really? Charlotte unicorn.
For the most part. I grew up actually – was born here, but grew up in Europe, but moved back as a teenager. So my folks are Dutch, lived in Holland from a little tot to about middle school.
And I didn't know that.
Came back in the early 80s, like 81, we moved back to the States.
That's so cool.
And have lived mostly in and out of Charlotte for the most part since then.
That's really cool.
The last time I moved back was about 97. I think I lived in Seattle, came back. Been here ever since.
So which place did you like the most? Because I really like Seattle.
I love Seattle. It's one of my favorite cities.
It's really cool.
Although Charlotte's just a fantastic place to raise a family, to live. It's close to the beach, the mountains, and there's no bad thing about Charlotte. Yeah. Seattle is stunning.
I mean, it's on my list.
Summer,
I haven't been
is
yet.
Unbelievable.
Have to go.
It's on my bucket list.
I used to live there as well. It's a different kind of beautiful.
It is. It is. But I love the two.
Yeah, I just, the weather, I don't know that I can do a year round.
I need some sunshine.
It's only like 4 months of gray.
Ooh, that's a lot. So
get bright lights in your house. And,
yeah, you know. Supplement with artificial.
You do. You have to. Otherwise you go crazy.
Oh, I like learning that fun fact about you. So you did answer how long you've been back in the Charlotte community in between. Can you tell us one authentic thing about yourself?
Authentic. I'm a pragmatic person. I tend not to get worked up over things. To Robin, my wife's Robin, her dislike, I think a lot of times I'll let things sit because anything that is a problem tends to fix itself over time if you don't bother with it instead of having to get involved, right? So whether it's kids' disagreements, business disagreements, it's like, you know what? I'll let people rest on it, and eventually they'll come around. So that's sort of how I operate.
Yeah. Well, it's I like the style, and I like the balance that you and Robin bring together. Mm-hmm. Since we get to work with both of you guys, it's really fun. Yeah.
More type A.
Yeah. Which,
hey, Robin.
Hey, Robin, if you're listening. And I realized that I started the podcast as if, like, everybody knows about our work with you guys. But we've been helping you guys buy – land, mm-hmm. in the Charlotte region in high opportunity areas or areas that are rapidly growing and changing and have a trajectory to become those high opportunity areas. We'll talk about that more, but we just wanted to make sure that we lay that foundation. That's one of the
main
things.
We're buying land to preserve it for affordable housing.
Yes.
Specifically. Right?
Yes.
So it's not we're just randomly buying land.
Yes.
Okay. Got it.
Thank you for clarifying, y'all.
Well, we usually invite our guests to pick an affirmation card. Are you open to doing that?
I'm open to doing it. I have no idea what it is.
So it's just like a positive message.
Okay.
And you can just randomly choose from the deck.
Choose from the deck. All right. This one's got to be your favorite. I am willing to see my sameness with others. This opens my awareness to oneness.
How does that fall on you?
It falls on me to the story that you shared with me earlier today. It's like we're all just human.
Yeah.
Right? People are people. It's human beings are human beings. Some people look different. Some people believe different. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, yeah, people are people, and all humans have similar needs and wants in life.
Absolutely.
I love that. I am willing to see my sameness with others. This opens my awareness to oneness. I think the thing that stands out from that is this is not about focusing on your differences, mm-hmm. but about our sameness.
Yeah.
And the concept of oneness, and that's something that I've, you know, we've been in conversations with, maybe not on the podcast, but that, you know, what if we are all one? We're all interconnected, and we all have likenesses that can connect us, and that's a really powerful card. That's very cool.
It wants me to go down the road to ask you, because we're here to talk about philanthropy today, do you think that card resonates with the meaning of philanthropy in any way, or the fact that people give because they do see others within themselves or want people to have equal opportunities?
I think in my space of philanthropy, probably yes, right? Because we are in the human services business, which is dealing with folks who are struggling, but people are still people. People are trying to do the best for their family.
Right? Yeah.
There are other forms of philanthropy that have completely different interests that probably are not necessarily aligned to that. But in our space, absolutely it is.
That's cool. And I don't think I've ever thought about any other forms of philanthropy that there is.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, gosh.
Oh, yeah.
You want to enlighten me just a little quick tidbit?
I mean, I'm not going to take us down a political route, but you know, there's all sorts of nonprofits that are formed to do things that are not necessarily in human interest focused.
Well, or they're in their own political interest focused.
Yeah.
They, as a 501c3, you can't lobby, but you can advocate for certain policies, and there are organizations that advocate for policies. There's organizations that are focused on the environment, on animals, on, you know, international development, on all sorts of things. Country clubs are nonprofits.
Really?
They are, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm learning so much from Andy today.
Now, I don't think you can write that off, but they operate as a private club, right?
I would have never guessed that.
Churches are nonprofits, right? So donating to your church often is perceived as philanthropy, which if that's your interest, absolutely go for it, right? But it's there's all sorts of philanthropy in the world.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Thank y'all for the gems. So what or who inspired you to get involved in philanthropy? And was there a specific moment or experience that shaped your commitment to giving back?
I want to hear about that too. Don't get me wrong. You said to give impact.
To give back.
Oh, I said to giving back.
Oh.
Giving
back. Sorry. We're going to need to tune that down on the soundboard. I swear I thought you said your commitment to give back instead of, or to give impact instead of giving. Edit.
You know, I think a lot of it stems into how you're raised. Mm-hmm. Right? And I think I was just grew up in an environment where it was normal that if you had excess resources, you gave back, and that's not just cash. It's volunteering. It's support service. It's other things. So personally, it's just sort of an ingrained thing in our lives. Professionally, I run a family foundation, which is a profession, not necessarily a personal thing. I left the tech business in 2018 at a convenient time where the family was looking for someone to lead a foundation that had grown beyond the capacity to be a family project. And in some sense, I got drafted.
Who led it before you?
My father did. And it was, it simply got too big and too cumbersome to run. Either, I got drafted or I was voluntold. Mm-hmm. But I'm honored to be able to do it, and I enjoy it, and it's been a fulfilling path ever since.
I think you're the right man for the job. You do a great job. So your father, did he inspire you, or was it something that you just felt led to do, or like it was just a voluntold thing?
It was an opportunity that opened, and I couldn't – it's one of these things you can't turn down when it's in front of you.
Yeah.
Right? I could have gone back into industry. I worked in the tech space. I traveled insane distances and hours. And to be able to work from home in Charlotte, most of my work's here, to do something where I'm not subject to airline schedules, factory schedules, deadlines that are – not in my control, to be able to set the pace and control those paces, it was appealing as well.
And did you have kids at the time?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Well, 2018 wasn't that long ago.
No, it wasn't.
That's 7 years ago?
7 years ago, yeah.
I forgot how old you are.
My baby is 21.
Wow, so, I did not know that. It's so exciting.
So, running a travel schedule with little ones in the house when they were all young, they could be tedious at times.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, and we were talking about this before we get in the podcast because, it's easy to go straight in and talking about the work stuff and trying to define, what is all that stuff, but versus the goal of talking about person. And we told Andy we wanted to make sure that a healthy portion of our conversation was about you. Mm-hmm. You, the person, Andy, who we've been working with. But I want to make sure, especially in the context of everything we just talked through, I think it'll be helpful for the listeners to know, who is the Maroncas Foundation?
Sure.
How in the world did y'all get started? Okay. And, where did that come from? Because I find it both the long and the short version are very interesting.
Okay. Yeah.
And how you ended up in that course also becoming an engineer and, all that stuff.
God, so let's rewind to where it all starts. Is my mother and father moved to the States and permanently moved in the 1967 or so. And they and a colleague of theirs started a business called PCA. And PCA was a photography business that took pictures in the back of Kmarts. And anybody that's old enough remembers their family dragging them to Kmart, sitting in the back
of the studio.
Mine did. Yeah. Take the pictures. That business at one point was one of the largest employers in North Carolina. It went public in the early 70s. My folks exited the business in the late 70s, but were fortunate that, they got – sometimes it's all about luck and timing, right? Got out at the right time. And fast forward another 10 years, they at one point decided they had enough resources of their own that they didn't necessarily want to hang on to. I think they were believers in the Carnegie method of philanthropy. It's like your goal should be to – give most of it away, and if you don't need it, and your kids can make their own money, right? Give them an education, make sure they get what they need when they're raised, but set them into the world and set them free. So they launched this foundation in the late 1989, 1990 or so. And over the course of the years since then, it has exponentially grown faster than we ever anticipated. To the point where, we were giving away 50 grants a year, then 80 grants a year, and get to 2020, we're like, oh my God, because as these assets grow, you're required to give a certain percentage away, or the IRS gets unhappy with you. And we ended up at a point where we just had to hire staff, at which point I stepped in. I said, okay, I'll take this. I'll figure out how to make this work. We are now doing about 150 grants a year.
Wow.
Mostly in Charlotte. A little bit in Atlanta, a little bit in New Jersey, but mostly in Charlotte. And we've taken what was, disjointed family philanthropic project, which was sort of kitchen table, if you ever got to meet, really, to now we are, we have a board and we've set a set of tracks. These are the things that we are interested in and focused on. So we've really taken a ship that was sort of spreading too far and too thin into something more focused.
But then so before this, though, I mean, so you grew up with this, your parents had achieved the success, mm-hmm. but they encouraged you guys all to go get your own education and have mm-hmm. your own careers.
Yep.
So each of your siblings, has their own, their own path.
Yeah.
And you went down the path of?
I was a Georgia Tech engineer and uh-huh. went into robotics. And none of this has to do with the philanthropy side, but ended up getting a fellowship to do some graduate work at the University of Washington. Worked for Microsoft for a little bit. And through that, I was working in the hardware business, which was not really the Microsoft cool side of the business. It was the stuff that people weren't interested in, mice and keyboards at the time. This is pre-Xbox, pre-joysticks, pre-everything else. And the contractors we were using were making more money and growing faster than Microsoft was. And so when an opportunity opened up at one of these contractors, I jumped from the OEM side or the folks who are designing the product to the backside of the business, which is how do you build it? In the electronics space, there are 5-6 giant contractors in the world that make most of your electronic stuff, the mics we're talking to today, the board. None of it's made by the company that has the brand on it. Mm-hmm. It's all made by a third party.
What?
And that was our business. And some claim it was the outsourcing of America, too. I mean, there's a lot of that business that was U.S.-based. It's now China-based or Mexico-based or Eastern Europe. That was a rapidly growing industry, and I happened to jump into that industry sort of at a very young point and exit at a very mature point. So
yeah,
I was fortunate.
Well, and one of the reasons why I wanted to bring that up is because especially someone who sits on the other side of the table – and also, I have an engineering brain. I can appreciate, engineers want to understand how things work. Mm-hmm. And so when you got introduced to housing, you're like, I want, breaking it apart, the pieces and the components, and okay, how does this all fit together?
Yeah.
And not everybody does that. And so it was fascinating to watch. And you guys zoned in on, okay, well, there's one part of this process that is broken and is not working.
Yeah.
Let's just focus on trying to do something there while everybody else is continuing, work on all these things. But I love watching your, and now we've kind of got you hooked on thinking about how real estate works.
Well, so affordable housing is always fascinating, right? Because to me, and going fast forward to our role as a foundation, is we were always late to the game, right? So, we're a funding operation, right? So we are basically an investment business that writes checks. And our nonprofit agencies in town, the ones that build affordable housing, would typically find a piece of property or have it donated or find something cheap, get a plan together, right? And they wouldn't really approach us until it's like, okay, I've got a parcel, I got a plan, I have permissions, right? Because they want to come to an organization like us with all their ducks checked and says, and now we're short $500,000, $1 million, whatever the number happens to be, will you help us fill that gap, right? And inevitably, every time we saw one of these, it was the property location was underneath the runway of the airport or next to the worst schools in the city or in places where if you wanted to choose where you wanted to live, that was not sort of the top of the list. And I get it, right? Because they have economic constraints, and that's the way their model works, and that's where they can get land. I mean, for-profit developers are grabbing the good stuff. So we entered that space because we felt like we could compete with the for-profit developers, grab the land earlier in the process, and then donate it back out to our partners so they had the opportunity to build housing in more attractive locations. That's the simple reason we got into it. I thought it was going to be really easy to just buy a parcel, call a partner, and say, hey, I have a piece of land, here you go. It hasn't quite been that simple, but I've learned a lot in the process.
Yep.
Absolutely. Well, outside of affordable housing, what causes are closest to your heart and why?
Again, on a personal basis, we are all over the place sometimes, right? We do, our family's big into women's reproductive rights. We've supported the local museums, schools, you know, schools the kids have gone to, schools the kids haven't gone to. Public radio has been a big program that we've supported. And all that is, you know, from a personal aspect. And you know, my wife serves on a few boards. I try not to serve on boards because now it's a bit of a conflict as to what I do for a living. On the foundation side, it's pretty well wired in. We are strictly focused on providing, you know, individuals and families who live on the economic margins, the support and resources they need to move themselves out of poverty. And, you know, we've really have lined into three strategies there. It's affordable housing. And for us, affordable housing starts at shelters. It's roof above. It's Salvation Army. Transitional housing, supportive housing, you know, for rent, for and for sale product that's all targeted at that space. The and some wraparound things like Beds for Kids that provide furnishings and such for families that in need.
Shout out to Beds for Kids. Yeah. Hey, Lauren.
That's about a third of our, and we sort of divvied up by how we spend our money. It's about a third of what we do. And you guys are in that pool of a third in this land banking exercise. We also spend quite a bit of resources in education. And for us, for now, education starts at, you know, pre-K type programming through, you know, elementary, middle, high school, and focus on the VOTEC side of post-high school. We really don't dabble into the college space. There's lots of funding in that space. There's lots of, you know, well-publicized scholarships people can get, and I think the VOTEC tracks are underfunded. And the final third we call well-being, but it's really it's a catch-all, but it's not. It's individual family well-being. It's health, safety, food. You know, think TV shelters, food banks, food pantries, community clinics, those types of things. Even community neighborhood development organizations that are focused on a specific neighborhood. How do you get that neighborhood healthy? So those types of programs. So that's how we do it on the professional side. On the personal side, it's really, you know, broader, and, you know, what our personal interest and being.
Yeah.
I love that. How do you choose the organizations or projects that you support within those rooms?
All right. So again, personal side is really personal interest, right?
Yes.
And we have our favorites, and we try to support those as best we can, you know, some years more than others. From the foundation standpoint, it's does what we are looking at, is it additive to what program we already support, right? Because we have a pretty robust portfolio. We know most of the players in the space. Is there a project or a program or an idea that can move that needle forward? And how does the leadership of that organization sort of fit with us, right? Because, you know, some of it's trust on our part to say, okay, I'm just going to provide the resources I can't be the expert. We are not going to be the expert. We'll never be the expert. We got to trust that you're the expert in that space and that you can execute a plan, right? And so it's confidence in leadership and the ability for them to articulate that this particular initiative will move the needle beyond where it is today or be additive to a program that we already support. Because otherwise I may just take the existing programs and say, okay, we'll just make that one bigger.
Yeah.
That's the other way to do it.
So do you look for creative and new people like that are doing innovative things, mm-hmm. trying to step out of the box versus reinvent the wheel?
A little of both. Innovative and new is hard to come up with sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
But when it shows up, we will certainly fund it. And there's also a good argument to be made for if something works, just make it bigger, faster, stronger, right? And I think we do a little of both.
Well, and you guys, I mean, in case we have somebody listening who's a nonprofit that's like, ooh, tell me more, that happens to work with what I work on. So you guys fund 2 times a year, and if mm-hmm. I remember correctly, folks have to go onto your website and apply, like get pre-screened.
Yeah.
Right? So they get vetted. You've got Deepa who, you know, manages all that mm-hmm. stuff. Shout out to Deepa.
Hey, Deepa.
We love her.
Hi, Deepa.
Talk to us about what that process looks like. Can they come in at any time during the year and get pre-approved or go through the vetting process?
I think most institutional funders like us are slow-moving boats. And so if you are a nonprofit looking for quick cash, it's probably not your best place to start. We should be part of your long-term development plan. To get to us, we have a two-stage process. One we call Are We a Match? And the second one is a grant request. So Are We a Matches are open year-round. It is just a simple online, tell us who you are, what you do, why we should be interested, right? And it is intentionally short. It's intentionally open-ended. Part of the test is can you articulate something that piques our interest? If you can't articulate it, then it's probably not a good fit. And we get hundreds of those a year. I mean, a lot. Of those, we probably only move forward like, half a dozen. Because we already know our existing portfolio of grantees. We're looking at what do we add.
Yeah.
And then every year some drop off, so what do we backfill? If from the Are We Match, if there's an interest, we will reach out. There'll be some pre-grant due diligence that our team will do, and then if you're approved, you'll get an access code and apply. The team will let you know when that cycle is. It's either spring or fall, in which we issue grants, and you'll probably already know by the time you apply. You already know what you've been guided as to what to apply for. Right, so it's not going to be a mystery.
That's good.
There's no once you're in that cycle. You'll get some good instructions.
Do you know who your longest standing grantee, are you allowed to say?
I do, yeah, I can. So 35 years was last year. Habitat for Humanity in its entirety. We think we started in Matthews, then moved, my folks lived in Matthews, and then we moved to Huntersville, and now it's Charlotte. But Habitat for Humanity in some form or another. Roof Above, Men's Shelter, has been a grantee since day one. Planned Parenthood has been a grantee since day one.
Awesome.
So those three.
Fantastic. Yeah. Well, we'll shout out to Laura Belcher and Liz Clayson Kelly. I don't know who runs Planned Parenthood. I can't give you a shout out, but shout out for doing all the work you're doing if you're listening. but okay, back up. Keep me on topic.
Did you say your second one? So your first one is Are We a Match?
That's right.
You said you have two, right?
Well, it's a grant request.
Okay.
Which is by invite only.
Oh.
Right, which if you are an existing grantee, you should know what that invite code is. If you don't, you need to talk to your development managers and say, learn how to do this. And if you're a new grantee, you'll be provided an access code. So generally, we don't get grant requests that we don't expect.
And how do you come across new potential grantees, like outside of the Are We a Match, like someone that you want to send a request to? Is it through someone you know, word of mouth?
Sometimes. So not often.
Yeah.
I'd say 95% of folks that we are fund, if it's a new funder, new grantee, they will have come in through an RWE match and provided us some information. And they may come multiple years in a row. There's many times we get requests. It's like, it's an interesting idea. We just don't have the capacity to deal with it this year, or you need more time to develop it a little bit more, come back a year from now. And we've had folks come back 2, 3, 4 years in a row. There are times where, you know, one of our board members picks up the phone and calls us and said, hey, I've heard a great story. I've heard a great anecdote, or I know someone who is doing this kind of work. Mm-hmm. Can you guys reach out and talk to them? And we'll do that. But we'll still screen them through the same screening process. It's not like a board member says, here's my pet project, pick it up and run with it. It still has to fit the criteria of what works and doesn't work for the foundation.
Yeah. Well, and I imagine, I mean, when we were just talking about adding new grantees, we were also talking about focusing on the ones that you guys have, that y'all have longstanding relationships with. And I'm sure, or I would imagine, this past year might be difficult for a lot of those organizations with some uncertainty around if any of them utilized federal funding or other things like that. Do y'all ever get involved in collaborating with other foundations or other funders that are working with those large organizations that are experiencing change?
I would say the dialogue amongst other family foundations is robust. I mean, our teams communicate pretty regularly. So we're pretty well aware of who else is funding, to what levels, what they expect to do differently in this year or next year. But those decisions are usually made individually. So we don't necessarily base our decision based on what one of the other foundations in the community is going to do, right? We're all independently making those calls. And, you know, there's a lot of organizations that do have dependencies on federal dollars, either directly or indirectly or tertiary dependencies that have seen reductions in funding or have lots of uncertainty in front of them. And, you know, the message from us is philanthropy, ourselves included, isn't going to solve that hole, right? It's not like we are going to step in and say, here, it's fixed. But we're well aware that it's out there, and I think our goal in this environment is to become that dependable partner, that if you continue to perform and you continue to communicate well with us, we will continue to provide funding. We're going to absorb the market risk on the back end.
Yeah.
Right? Because that's our business, right? We take risks so the community can benefit from those risks. And you know, if we take too much of a risk, then we have a problem. But
yeah,
that's what we do.
Yeah.
And not for me to go down the political road, but we know SNAP benefits and different things are about to get cut, and health insurance and costs are about to rise for families. So for the organizations and nonprofits who support the community in those ways, are y'all prepared with knowing what's coming up in the economic climate to support them or to set a little bit more aside just because of the news?
I don't like to chase the news. As I said earlier, I was a pragmatic guy, right? So I'm not going to go panic because there's a change in the air.
Yeah.
I think some of it is a good test of a lot of organizations' sort of preparedness for risk, for downsides. We're going to see some organizations go under. We have seen some organizations go under. You're going to see some thrive because they said, you know what? We know how to solve for that problem, and this is how we're going to go do it. You know, we cannot be that fallback for everyone, right? We can adapt a little bit here and there, right? The only thing that we can offer or make a pretty consistent offer on is we will remain consistent. We are not going to surprise you.
And that is, I cannot tell you how amazing that is. There's a lot of value in that.
And if there's a problem, we will be upfront about it. So yeah. There's going to be a problem. It's going to change next year. Here's what the change is going to be. Yeah. But it won't come through the grant request. So if you've made a grant request, we are typically upfront about what's coming.
Of some of the work that you've been involved in, is there anything that stands out to you that has just like a story you've heard afterwards or an experience you've had volunteering with one of these organizations? It's just something that you're like reinvigorates you, fills your cup back up.
Yeah. So I do have it, and it's in context of one of the questions you had for me earlier, right? Was how do you measure success or something like that? And it's really hard. On the individual side, it's impossible to measure success, right? The only thing you can think of is if this organization didn't exist, would the community be better or worse? And if it would be better, then that's why we're personally supporting Planned Parenthood or the Mint or whoever we decide to personally support. But on the institutional side, that is a question that we often get asked as well. It's like, how do you measure impact? And it's really, really hard. And I think it's easier in housing, your space, mm-hmm. right? Because you can measure number of roofs, number of families, it's really hard in education because what you do today is going to impact somebody 18 years from now when they graduate. And did they learn to read well in third grade impacts how they do as a senior in high school. Those tools, even though people try to sell you that they know how to measure that, it's really, really hard.
But in the education space, could you do it by teacher retention?
You could do it any way you like. It's still really hard to say that number is impacting a child in third grade such that they're successful in adulthood.
Yeah, right? I imagine it's difficult because it's a long trajectory and
so many factors.
I mean, when you've got so many factors moving.
If we're helping retain teachers, which is a great initiative, mm-hmm. right? And the CMS Foundation has got initiatives around teacher retention. And in the housing side, there's how do you get a better affordable housing for teachers? But does that help a child whose family moves from school district to school district every year? So they've been in six different schools over 7 years with a bunch of different teachers and different curriculum, and they just got lost in the system, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
So there's all sorts of factors that really – or that child comes to school hungry every day, right? They're not going to learn even if the teacher's good.
Well, yeah, and to that point, what you were saying, it took my brain there. Like, could you measure, like, how many meals are given a day or in a school year, how many kids are being fed?
Yeah.
Do you allocate your money and your funds and your support to help with those specific things?
I want to redirect for just one second.
Okay.
Because, Courtney, you're being awfully quiet over there across the table. But all this conversation is making me think of you. And I want you to wave your magic wand for a second. I'm going to hold up my pen. Andy, you just got a copy of your pen. This is a magic wand.
All right. Oh, that is okay. A magic wand.
It is. It actually says, this is a magic wand. We'll show you guys online. But this is from our 5-year anniversary event 2 weeks ago. And this is a question we ask a lot of. Okay, if you could come from an abundance mindset, take away all the barriers and, to not limit your thinking and wave your magic wand, what would the answer be? And this one's a little bit different than that. This is not just big dreaming, but you have so much experience working with families and individuals, and this is so complex. And I'm just curious if you have anything immediate that comes to mind that you're like, these one or two things are like really indicators that somebody's making a difference in the life of a child or an individual or anything like that. Is there anything that pops in your mind?
You're right. I've been quiet because I've been soaking it all in. Andy, I just want to say thank you.
No problem.
And I know that it can be difficult to really determine what is the impact that you're making, mm-hmm. right? And there's so many ways that you can do that.
Yeah.
And I just want to take the opportunity to thank you because the work that you're doing not only directly impacted the lives of the 534 men I had the chance to serve when I was at Urban Ministry Center, mm-hmm. but it significantly impacted my life.
Well, good. I'm glad to hear that.
To be able to see, people got their lives back.
Yeah.
To see a man come in with his belongings in a garbage bag, mm-hmm. to hand him keys after he passed his urine analysis because he was drug and alcohol free. To watch him open the door, to see him show up the next day, waking himself up, coming into treatment, and then 3 months later graduating.
Yeah, that's awesome.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
And, I thought I would do that work forever. And one thing that's been really challenging for me that Maya and Liz have just, Well, I'm not going to go there because it's going to make me emotional. But one thing I've struggled with is, how do you make a difference in the world?
Yeah.
Or how do I make a difference if I'm not doing that meaningful work?
Yeah.
And so to see you and to see what you're doing is just another reminder of, we can show up genuinely and authentically as ourselves, and that makes a difference in the world.
We used to have a tagline for the foundation, we haven't used it in a long time, called Making a Difference One at a Time.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And the intent for that was, because you get a lot of requests for funding, it's like, will you fund research into how to do something? And he's like, you know what? Our funding really should go to programs to make a difference in an individual's lives, like mm-hmm. the Urban Ministry Center, or Roof Above now, such that you could actually talk to the person that received those benefits. And I'll go back to the earlier question of, have you ever run into somebody that has received these benefits? I ran into, we did a volunteer day as a foundation with Rebuilding Together, which is a program we fund. We love Rebuilding Together. The woman, and I don't recall her name, was the lead foreman, project manager for Rebuilding Together. I said, oh, where'd you come from? And she goes, oh, I got my building management vocational degree from CPCC on a Maronca scholarship. And then prior to that, it's like, well, where'd you go to high school? So you're from Charlotte. She goes, yeah, I went to the ROC, which is a VOTEC high school program. So three programs we supported are now providing a livelihood for this woman who is making a living in construction management.
At a nonprofit.
At a nonprofit.
Who's making a difference
right.
in the world.
Rebuilding homes for mostly seniors that are shut in because they don't have the ramps or their bathrooms don't work and whatnot. And that is, when you talk to a person like that, you're like, okay, it worked, mm-hmm. right? At least it worked for that person, and that person is then yet again giving back to the community. And those things, occasionally you'll run into stuff like that, not three programs at a time, but you'll run into people who said, okay, yes, I received services from this organization or that organization. It's made a difference. And that's the validation that what you're doing is the right thing.
Yeah.
It's amazing. What kind of legacy do you hope to leave behind?
Yeah, so, I'm not in it for the legacy. I don't think me personally, I don't think the foundation's in it for the legacy. I don't think anyone is thinking about what will people remember. I think our concern is the community a better place tomorrow than it is today? And is it, if and when, everything has its cycle, and when we go out of business, will the community be better off because we existed? That's probably the legacy, but that's not really what we're focused on necessarily.
What about for you personally, like for your future grandchildren? And your family.
And your grandchildren.
To like leave on what your dad started.
Ever.
You're totally going to be a fun grandpa.
Like, yeah, for sure.
That's all I need to be. Right? that he was a good person that cared about people. Right? That's all I can hope for.
I love that. I'm sure your dad is really proud of you.
He is.
And your
I
siblings.
Hope so. We'll
see. We are.
Yes.
And thank you guys for all the help you've given us, right? We, just for the audience, we stepped into this idea that we could buy land and give it away because land's an asset, stock's an asset, so it's the same thing. And giving away funds is easier, and land is a little harder. And we said, you know what? Mm-hmm. We don't know what we're doing. And somebody connected us with Liz, and ever since then, this program has thrived and launched, which we are incredibly grateful for. I don't think we could have done it without you guys.
Well, and it's something y'all may not think about often, but I know we do, is that by allowing us to serve you guys, which is like a win-win. Like, mm-hmm. like if I could wave my magic wand before we met you guys, mm-hmm. this is what I waved my wand for. This and like several other things that we're working on, and it has been a joy to work on it. But it is because of this work with you guys, it has fed our souls and our work and our ability to be a team together. And I know Megan's not here, and Megan's a big part of the land bank work. And so it's more than just like a business transaction. And it's mm-hmm. And I know we're not a 501c3 or anything, but it's still like this, it's symbiotic and it allows us to go out and serve the community and do other work. So we're super, super grateful. And I know there's a lot of people, probably other listeners from like the city and the county, who are all, and other funders who are always asking questions about like, you know, why? Why did this? And I know we talked about that early on, but I love that when we started this work with you guys, y'all were just, we just want to go do the right thing. And we don't want to get stuck in all the red tape, which sometimes, you know, there's red tape for a reason, to help protect, you know, public funds and, you know, other things like that. But you guys have the nimbleness to go, and I say that feels right, that looks right, that smells right. Like, let's go take risk that other entities don't have the ability to take.
Yeah.
And let's just buy it and hold it, and we can wait for the right thing, right development team, right project plan to align.
Right.
And we're not forced to, you know, because sometimes when you're buying land with other types of capital, you got a timeline. And if you're paying, you know, double-digit returns or any type of, you know, returns on that land, you've got, you know, a pressure clock on it that can force people to maybe not do the most missional thing or mission-aligned thing. And so it's very cool to see this function exist in our market, that where we've been able to buy, 120
acres.
Yeah, almost at 120 acres, and we've got a couple other under contract, you know, in all quadrants of the city now, where we're, you know, going to be able to bring access and support local developers, and which is pretty darn cool.
Yeah, and we stepped into it because, A, we were frustrated where we were in that process. I said that earlier, but also there was no other organization doing this, right? I mean, had someone else existed in this space, we probably wouldn't be here right now. Right, I'd rather, had it already existed, just scaffold that up and make that more successful. So, and maybe in the future, there is an entity that can do this on a bigger scale.
Yeah.
It'd be even better.
Yeah.
Right. I'd love for that to happen.
If we have any listeners interested in this concept, feel free to always message us. And
message,
or if you know,
Liz, not me.
Yeah. Yeah, message me or Maya. Or if you know of other folks doing land banking in other markets. I mean, this land bank functions different
like a land trust?
A land trust, thank you. I'm like, it was just right on the tip of my tongue. It's not the same as a land trust because you guys are either, you know, ground leasing it or you're selling it with a permanent deed restriction. And so there's a lot of similarities, but it's different.
A land trust generally will continue to own the underlying land and just sell the homes. Mm-hmm. And we don't have any intention of doing any real work beyond the gift, outbound gift. There is, and I looked at it the other day, some national organization for land banks. About 300 of them nationwide or so. Most of them are quasi-municipal entities that are dispositioning, you know, dilapidated properties, tax repossessions, those types of things. I've not really seen anything like we're doing because we are privately held.
Mm-hmm.
We sort of have that ability to decide what we're going to go work on and what we're not going to work on.
Yeah.
Well,
and I don't typically give advice on the podcast, but if I can give advice to other listeners, you just make sure you have the right team if you're going to go out and buy land. Don't just see a parcel you think you like and just
go buy it. I learned that lesson the hard way.
Yeah, like there's due diligence. There's lots of questions to ask and things to understand, and having the right advisory team, legal team, brokerage team. They have all those rules for a reason, and the intent is to try and protect.
I'll admit I was on vacation and I saw a really cheap piece of land come up and I put an offer on it. And Liz and Megan's like, you did what? That thing's terrible. That's such a bad idea. So, needless to say, we now do not own that.
We do not own that land. That was a funny one. You know, it had some potential.
Maybe.
It had some potential, but we quickly determined that it did not have long-term potential. And wasn't worth it. Sometimes you have to look. You have to, you know, decide if we can't buy all the land, you know, which ones should be our priority be. And, that one did not work out. But that's, you know.
Lesson learned.
Yeah.
Well, Liz may not give advice typically, but I will ask Andy, What advice would you give to emerging philanthropists or just people who are looking to make an impact through their dollars?
Philanthropists, go with your gut. Don't overstudy a problem. If it looks right, smells right, feels right, and you have the excess funds to be able to support that, go do that. Don't ask for permission from others. Don't make your decision based on what others may think about it. Right? If it's right for you, it's right for you, and do it. I mean, the purpose of gifts and philanthropy is to enable an entity to be successful, and that's really what you should be focused on.
I love that. What about nonprofits or organizations looking for support? What advice would you give to them if they are sending in a request?
Or asking somebody individually? Yeah, so know your audience. You'd be amazed how many folks ask for money but really don't understand what either I care about personally, Robin cares about personally, or what our foundation cares about as an institution, right? And making an ask that doesn't align with what our interests are is rarely going to be successful.
Like do your research.
Yeah, know your audience.
Yeah.
Right? Know your audience, communicate effectively. Right? As I said, are we a match is purposely open-ended? Because if you can articulate in short form
sometimes less is more.
Yeah, it's articulate why are you writing this? What are you asking for? What's it going to do? Why should I care? Why should I care? It goes back to what do I care about, right? That's mm-hmm. why I should care. So communication, good communication is important. And then, as you get further along in a funding relationship, there are going to be moments where your business takes a downturn, something bad happens, bad news. Over-communicate to those people who are supporting your operation, your program, your project. They will generally be not as critical as you. It's not a bad idea to deliver bad news quickly and fast and say, this is what's happened, this is what's going on. Will you still stand by me? And the answer 99% of the time is going to be yes, right? Because there are instances we've run into where they're trying to hide the fact that you're running out of money. It's like, well, if you're running out of money, by the time you run out, it's too late to come ask me to help you, right? If you need help getting contacts to add board members or to you want to run a fundraising plan by us, that's stuff we can help with, right? But you got to do that early. You can't wait till the end.
Yeah, well, and I'm sure that's got to be in my mind. I imagine that can be intimidating for some folks come not necessarily hat in hand, but to say,
I'm in trouble.
Oh man, I need
I'm in trouble.
Clearly, right. Something needs to change. Like we need input.
And sometimes that's all we give is just an opinion, and we have lots of opinions, not all of them good sometimes.
Yeah.
Right. But we have lots of opinions, and we're happy to share.
Yeah. So that's good. That's good to know to put that out there and say, we want people to ask us and yeah.
We will never claim to be the experts at your business or any the programming side, right? Because we're just not set up to do that.
Yeah, but I can say, as somebody who has worked very closely with you guys, all of you are wicked smart.
100%.
You may not know their business the way they know it, but
we know our business.
You know your business, and y'all are all incredibly, incredibly smart.
That's the team that works for me, not me.
Oh. But all of them, every single one of you.
They make me look better than I am.
Every single one of you are that way. So it's really awesome. Charlotte is lucky to have you guys. I'm grateful for your parents' vision and leadership. Yeah. And, it's a ripple effect. You just never know where all this stuff can lead. And so I love what you said about just finding the thing that you care about. If it smells right and feels right, just go do it.
Yeah.
And trying to not get so caught up in what other people think.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that can hold a lot of folks back. But it can be really powerful to just lean into what you feel is right for you.
Yeah.
And so I'm glad you guys are doing that.
Yeah. We're happy to do it.
Andy, thank you so, so, so much for being here with us today. It was so great getting to know you more, learning so many new things, and I hope our listeners did as well.
What's the new thing you learned?
Well, I didn't know you lived or grew up partly in Europe.
Oh, okay.
I did not know about the other forms of philanthropy.
All right, that's true.
So, yeah, so many things. Courtney, did you learn anything new today?
I learned a lot, and I feel like I was able to just soak it all in. I've heard your name and, you know, been in the room when you guys were getting ready to start a meeting, so it's just been really special to get to know you.
It's good to finally put a face to the person, right?
That's
seen on the screen.
Yeah,
so. It is. Liz, well, you want to close this out?
I am, and I have something. I don't know if you've listened to any of the other podcasts, but I'm gonna build on what we just ended with, in that I want each person who's listening to remember that not only are you worthy, but you are worthy to chart your own path, to choose the things that light you up, to pursue those things, and for it to be different than other people. I think that is a really, really beautiful thing. Yeah. And it's also okay if it's the same, if we find that sameness in others and lean into our awareness of oneness, we can have sameness and difference at the same time. And I think that's really cool. So as you go into the rest of your day, remember, you are worthy.